Welcome to Breaking News with Ben Hunt, Jack Forehand, and Matt Ziegler. Before we start, let me remind you what the show is not. Breaking News is not a show about fact-checking. Breaking News is not a show about saying whose bias is the one and only correct bias. And Breaking News is definitely not a show about calling out fake news. Breaking News is a show where we look at today's top stories and have a conversation around our favorite critical question, why am I reading this now? Drawing on the headlines we're tracking at fiatnews.com, join us as we talk about what's collectively making us tick with clear eyes, full hearts, and this obligatory disclaimer. Nothing in this podcast is advising you to buy or sell any security or to do anything with your money. Seriously, you should only act on investment advice from someone you know and someone who knows your unique situation. We are not that person.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Breaking News. I'm Matt Ziegler, joined as always by Jack Forehand. Say hello, Jack.
Hello, Jack.
And say hello, Ben Hunt.
Hello, Ben Hunt.
I mean, it'll never get old, right?
One, right, Matt? Nowhere. I mean, that's the old, you know, George Burns line, right?
Is there a
night, Gracie, and you know, she plays the dumb blonde. And, although she was really smart, you know, what she says, right. Good night, Gracie.
What's funny about it took me about 10 episodes to realize that was what I was supposed to do. So I was saying something else for about 10 episodes, and I'm like, you know what? They're saying that every time. I probably should look into what I'm supposed to be doing there.
Yeah, that actually was the funny part, Jen. You're right.
We'll do just the episode where we break down like Henny Youngman jokes and George Burns classic callbacks that deserve to be everywhere.
Perfect.
I'm all in for that. Jack, start us off with do the ad read. We have some promotions. We actually have some pretty friggin' amazing stuff going on, including a charity event, including some new podcasts. Can you remember all the things we have to promote at the top of this show?
I think I can. So first, okay. I want to promote through the separate channel that Matt and I work on, Excess Returns. We have something called P&L for a Purpose coming up on April 30th from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And what it is an all-day charity event. We're raising money for Susan G. Komen. We're going to have 24 guests, each in half-hour interviews over the course of 12 hours. So obviously, we're going to be a little bit tired at the end. And so we're really excited. If anybody who's interested in it, if you go to the Excess Returns channel and you click on the live link, you can click notify me and you'll get notified when we go live. And also, we're very fortunate that at 3 p.m. we have the great Ben Hunt joining us. And so
No. It's a great lineup, Jack. I'm so delighted to be part of it. And thank you for what you're doing. Fantastic.
And we'll also be bringing the band back together, because interviewing the great Ben Hunt will be me and Matt Ziegler. So we'll be bringing the Breaking News team together for a half hour at 3 p.m. on the 30th.
Can't wait.
And in addition to that, I got to keep the pitches going here. The Intentional Investor, new on the Epsilon Theory channel, hosted by Matt. I've done a podcast like for a while where we get into what's in someone's portfolio. And that's interesting. But what was missing from that in a lot of ways was, you know, their human capital, how they think about that, what's gone on over the course of their career, you know, their purpose. And so Matt's doing a great new podcast. The first guest was Ben again. That's already live on the Epsilon Theory channel. Also a really awesome video. And a lot of great stuff coming there too, Matt. You probably have some stuff to add beyond that.
Well, definitely go back and check out Ben's episode. We've got Justin Castelli, probably will come out right before this episode airs, which was kind of the demo episode and is fantastic. And yeah, we're talking about purpose. So instead of just talking about portfolio, there's a little thing, Ben, you like to say about clear eyes, full hearts, and not losing. I like to think this is completely in the vein of that idea.
It sure is. It sure is. And it's... I've decided to kind of go, we got to focus on the, we've been focused on the clear eyes, we've been focused on the full hearts. With all the uncertainty and everything else going on in the world, it's time to start focusing on the can't lose, because it's really the case. I mean, we come together with clear eyes, with full hearts, and we can't lose. It's important.
It's so important. And in the spirit of that too, over on, I just finally launched my Cultish Creative YouTube channel. Jack, we had Ben and Paul Millard, which should be up by this time out too here. And it's fantastic. We're talking about career paths and lives. And the idea with that show is get two people who might, may or may not talk to each other on the regular or even at all, and get them around a common answer and just show how we can have common ground in conversation. Because again, back to can't lose. We can't lose if we can talk to each other, which is what we're here to do today. Right, guys?
Right on.
Absolutely.
All right, so we have on Breaking News the Zeitgeist with a status update on Iran and Israel and what each side wants to signal with the recent attack and defense maneuvers. We have a tweet of the week looking at Cybertruck sales or perhaps their lack thereof. Jack, you've got a dumb question about Ukraine and joining the political kickball team, otherwise known as NATO. And I've got a cultish corner on the premeditated narrative of attack that was Conan O'Brien's Hot Ones appearance. But first, the big picture. It's a fiat news thing this week. We're talking NPR, aka National Public Radio, extra emphasis on the public. So Ben, start us here. What's been going on, and maybe kick us off with the op-ed about how NPR lost the trust of America.
Oh, sure. So it was a great, it was a really great article published by Uri Berliner. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. I may not be. He wrote it for the Free Press, which is Barry Weiss's new gig. Not that new now, but new gig. He's a senior editor at NPR. He's been at NPR for 25 years. And he's been the token, conservative, the token Republican for, I guess, easily the last 10 years. And what he's describing is the conscious editorial decision to stop reporting news and stories of interest to the public and to start telling the public how to think about the stories of the day. That's the article. And, the natural, punchback from NPR and a lot of the punching back was just like, well, you are proving Berliner's case here. It's just crazy stuff. It's all over. You can take a look at it. So he gets suspended by the new CEO at NPR. And after he gets suspended, he says, I resign. So what we wanted to do was, because we step back a second, the big claim, of course, is the takeaway that most people are having is that NPR is biased in a blue team, Democratic, woke way. And I believe that is the case in the same way that I believe that there are lots of media outlets a few media outlets that are heavily biased in the other direction. That's my opinion. I think that when you start talking about things like bias as the subject of your investigation or your research, it's really hard to do. In the same way, it's really hard to do, I think, fact-checking. I think that fact-checking and bias analytics are inherently biased and in and of themselves. I think the entire exercise is inherently flawed. What I don't think is flawed is to look at language and words. Forget about the left-right dimension. Forget about that. Look at the words that are used by anyone, left, right, up, down, to try to tell you how to think. This is what we do at Epsilon Theory with what we call our Fiat News project. Fiat News being our turn of phrase to represent, we talk about fiat money, it's made up money. Fiat news is the presentation of opinion as fact. Fiat news is trying to tell you how to think about the events of the day. And that you can track. You can absolutely track that. This is a pretty straightforward linguistic effort to say, okay, what are the words and phrases that you would categorize as opinion leading? And there's a long body of research into, literally going back to, Socrates and Aristotle about words that one uses, arguments that one makes to try to tell you how to think as opposed to making a sound argument or presentation of facts. So this goes back 2,500 years, trying to analyze linguistics on this dimension of how is your word choice, the phrases and all that you're using, how opinion leading is that? That we can measure at scale. And so that's what we did. And we've got the data on every US and UK media outlet, news media outlet for the last 2+ years. So going back to the start of 2022, we're getting more data to take it back farther, because in Berliner's telling, that is that NPR really made this editorial change in 2016 and then in 2020 around the Trump elections. We can't say whether there was a change. What we can say is what is happening today. And what is happening today is that NPR, National Public Radio, is out of 121 media outlets that we track, out of all of those American ones, it's number 6 in its use of opinion leading language. And what we're looking at is anything that gets written down, transcripts of broadcasts, any of the programs that goes up onto their website. That's what we're able to track. And it's the 6th highest of any outlet out there. Now, other outlets are higher. Number 1, Fox News. Big surprise, folks, right? Opinion leading language is not just used by the woke left. It's also used by the whatever you want to call Fox, whether it's MAGA right or right, but it's on the right. Number 1. And number 1 by a not small amount, Fox News is. It's about 20% higher than number 2. Number 2 being the New York Times. Right? So exactly who you would expect is on this list. MSNBC is on this list above NPR. Washington Post on this list above NPR. Also on this list above NPR, PBS News, which I thought was interesting, right? Another news organization with public in its name, but we're just talking about NPR rating. So what I can tell you for a fact is that, like other major news organizations, NPR is in the business today of telling you how to think about the news, shaking their finger at you, that's why I do this, and telling you how to think about the news. They're not about the business of reporting the news straight. As Jack is saying, they've got the word public in their name. And look, they make a big point about, well, actually, you know, we get very little of our operating budget from government money, from taxpayer money, to which you say, great. So you won't miss it so much when it's gone. Because right now it is taxpayer money for a media organ that is in the business of convincing you to think a certain way about the news. That's what's going on right now.
It's obviously not working now, you know, with opinion working its way into the news, but what was the original case for the government, like, funding news outlets?
So that there would be a publicly available, and radio was important in this regard. It's the same argument as public broadcasting in general, that there needs to be a non-commercial space, a non-paid for space, where citizens can get information about the world. And where that has definitely moved to today, for both PBS News and for NPR, is that they've moved from, like every other media outlet, they've moved from reporting the news straight, for being a reporter, for being an agent. My job is just to tell you the news, to being a principal, to say, I have a view on this, and I'm going to tell you the right way to think about this. This is journalism schools, you know, over the last 20 years. It's all of that. It's the transformation of news media from being an agent, reporting the news straight, to being a principal. I need to tell you how to think. So that was the original vision, reporting the new straight source of information for citizens that's available for free. And it's moved now to being just another partisan media outlet like all the rest. The difference being they get taxpayer money. So yeah, defund NPR. I can't, I mean, and as soon as I say that, right, everybody on the right, I'm sorry, it says, yay, you know, and everyone on the left says, oh my God, you know, you're on the right. And it's nothing to do with that, right? I think Fox News is an abomination. I really do. And don't get me started on those that are even farther out there, you know, One America Network and all these other, the more, you know, outright MAGA outlets. It's, you know, they're beyond the pale. I mean, they're just mouthpieces. But sadly, so is NPR today. So is PBS News. And it is, I think, unconscionable for public funds to be used for that.
Let's take it to the zeitgeist, the Middle East. We've got some things going on here again. And I think something I want your help in unpacking is Iran does this attack, heavily thwarted.
Yep.
Seems like they probably knew it was going to get thwarted. Seems like everybody's trying to figure out how to position around this thing. Can you unpack what's going on there?
A phony war. So that is the term given to the immediate direct outbreak of war between the major powers, Germany, France, England, for World War II. So Germany invades Poland. France first, other allied countries respond, the U.S., but the other allied European countries respond by declaring war on Germany. They start fighting directly, not through proxies, but they fight starting directly in the same way, you know, that we're now seeing direct conflict between the two. Neither Germany nor France, which was the main, you know, the main power here in the early stage of the war, had any interest in making it a real war. Now, it doesn't mean that real fighting didn't take place. There was real fighting directly between the countries, but it was it was not of a major, you know, offensives, and it wasn't a real war. And so it was called the phony war. It lasted for about 8 months. And I think that's about the timeline we've got here, because I think that jibes very well with the enormous volatility event that the United States is going to have in November, you know, 6 months from now. I think 8 months sounds about right to me for how long a phony war lasts. So that's where we are right now. It's a phony war, but it's a real war because it's direct now. It's no longer proxies and, oh, you know, we're not really fighting. Nope, you're really fighting now. It's just neither side is, it doesn't suit either side to make this a real big war.
Is this like... Yet. Is this like when two kids in the cafeteria or the schoolyard start like circling and everybody starts chanting fight, but the fight doesn't actually happen yet? Is this?
I kind of don't want to not trivialize it, but I think that those sort of interpersonal examples,
yeah,
they can have a surface similarity, but I'm really reticent to use them. I think it's its own thing. I think that when nations have violent armed conflict, the process is there is a domestic level degree of bargaining and public opinion bringing along that you've got to do. There is an international game that you're playing with your sponsors and allies and the like. It doesn't stop. And that's why, you know, the funny war lasted for 8 months and then, you know, the Germans said, oh, we know now how to get through the Maginot Line. We go around it. And I can promise you right now, the Iranians are thinking, how do we get around the ballistic defense systems that exist on Israel? So Iran's trying to figure out how to get around it. Israel knows that Iran is trying to figure out how to get around it. And if they can figure out a way to get around it, then what Israel needs to do is go hit them first. But hitting them now wouldn't make a lot of sense. So this is why there's a time period. It's not kind of circling around kind of, oh, fight, fight, fight. It's more, this is the dynamic of war. The war started. The war's not going to end. It's going to get, my view, a lot worse. But not for a little while. That's kind of my view about, you know, the world in general these days, guys, is that it's going to get a lot worse. But not for a little while. We've got about 6 months, 6 to 8 months, I think.
So you think until then, they're both going to be retaliating against each other, that they don't want to be the one who, you know, had the strike against them and didn't retaliate. So they're going to retaliate, but they're going to do so in such a way that it's not going to escalate the situation too much.
Yeah. And I think that's already happened, right? I think the Israeli attack on the reactor was basically telling Iran, you know, we can get to you. Your air defenses are for shit. We can get anywhere we want. And Iran said, yep, our air defenses are for shit. Your ballistic defenses are really good. We need time to figure out how do we get around that. What is our Ardennes forest? Is it Hezbollah in the north? Is it something else? Is it making the United States, you know, back away? They're looking for their Ardennes forest, their way of getting around the Maginot Line. And Israel's looking for, everyone knows that what the other person's trying to do. And so it always ends up in defection, meaning attack. But right now, that's where we are, the phony war, but it's a war all the same.
You talked in the last episode about Iran really doesn't have any reason to escalate this right now. You know, you mentioned they have some issues with their defense, but also they probably love what's going on in the United States right now. They're pretty happy to let that continue. How does Israel think about it? Like, why would they not want to escalate right now?
Well, I think Israel would escalate right now if they thought that Iran could find an Ardennes forest and get around their defensive line. I know they would. It's the difference between, sorry to get all kind of poli-sci, it's the difference between a preventive war and a preemptive war. A preventive war is when you go to war with somebody because you think, oh, in 5 years or 10 years, their economy will have grown and they'll be a threat. I'm going to prevent that threat from happening by attacking them now. That's not what Israel's done. What Israel has consistently done in its history, 1967 is the best example of this, is a preemptive war. Preemptive war is, oh, those guys are about ready to hit us. We're going to hit them first. So that was the 1967 war where they saw Egypt, in this case, Egypt and Syria, preparing their forces for an attack. And they said, okay, well, we're going to hit you first. Israel, I think it was 81, maybe it was 82, when they bombed the reactor, the nuclear reactor in Osirak. Same thing, right? So if they see an imminent amassing of forces, they're going to hit first. So that is what Israel will do. right now, I'm surmising that, okay, we knocked down, swatted down the first 300 missiles and drones and cruise missiles like that. There could be more. There could be another effort to get around our defenses, but we can hold off for now. We've still got fish to fry, you know, sorry for that metaphor, in Gaza. I mean, we've got to conclude this. So, yeah, there's no reason for Israel to make a major offensive move against Iran right now. But will they? If they think there's a hint of Iran's got something cooking that could actually be serious against them, oh, 100% they will. So that's what I'm saying. This is going to happen, but it's not going to happen yet. It's not going to happen for some months, my best guess. Right now, it's a phony war.
In a preemptive strike from my corner, Jack, the tweet of the week.
Yeah, this is great. And I actually didn't know a lot of this. So we're talking about Tesla and we're talking about the Cybertruck. And as you point out in the tweet, Ben, we've heard a lot about the Cybertruck in the media and all over the place. And I'll just read the tweet before I comment on it. But your tweet was, well, first of all, someone had written, new Tesla recalls all 3,878 Cybertrucks shipped to date because of a faulty accelerator panel. And you said, wait, fewer than 4,000 Cybertrucks have actually been sold and delivered to actual buyers. Tesla shareholders have invested billions of dollars, and we've all endured hundreds of hours of media for this. AYFKN, which, by the way, given that I'm not hip, I actually had to actually look up to see what that means. I won't say that on the podcast, but what is your take overall, Ben, on this? I'm very surprised there are only 4,000 Cybertrucks.
Well, look, so what I'm not surprised that there aren't a lot of Cybertrucks out there. I mean, this is what Tesla's been saying. Oh, we're ramping it up. It's going to take us a long time. It's a lot harder than you think. So I wasn't expecting, you know, 100,000 Cybertrucks out there. Was I expecting 40,000? Was I expecting 20,000? Yeah, I was. Less than 4,000 actual deliveries, actual Cybertrucks out there in the wild. That's crazy. I don't care how much you're ramping it up and, oh yeah, just wait till next year with deliveries. It's like, I also remember the last 20 years of, you know, autonomous driving and, you know, the 20 years of saying, oh yeah, your Tesla is going to be like a taxi and, you know, the autonomous driving is going to be great. And here we are, whatever, at 20 years. I mean, we're a good 10 years into the promises that it's always right around the corner. Tesla's just, I mean, Cybertruck feels to me just like that, but at a concrete expense of billions of dollars. And more than that, the opportunity cost. Okay, we're going to do this white elephant. Feels to me, I mean, we're going to do this instead of developing a lower price point Tesla. We're going to do this instead of refreshing our models that we currently have. These are choices. And it looks to me, it's been a choice to incinerate billions of dollars at the same time that the EV narrative has collapsed. We've talked about this on the show. We've written about this from earlier in the year. The whole EV story, and story is what drives multiple, story is what drives everything. The EV story has collapsed. It doesn't mean that EVs are going away. It doesn't mean that EVs aren't important. I get all that. I love electric vehicles. I love it. Fantastic. But the story has broken. And the Cybertruck, to me, fiasco, also that, okay, there are fewer than 4,000 that have actually been delivered to actual customers. And you're doing a mass recall because there's a little cover on the accelerator that's stuck. And so you just go into, you're just plowing through stuff where the accelerator gets stuck. All right. Again, AYFKM, right? I mean, it's all the piece. I'll calm down. But yeah, this is just like, it's, I wrote in the piece that it reminds me of, in the financial world, there have been a couple of big, I'm not saying that Tesla's a fraud. I'm saying that there's fraudulent claims. Fraud's a big word. Let's stop back on that. I use the word common knowledge breakdown. So the last biggest one in my world was the common knowledge collapse around Enron. Because Enron was a fantastic company. It was, that was, everyone knew that Enron was, they were the smartest guys in the world. Famous name from the book about Enron. They were the smartest guys in the world. They figured out how to trade energy. They were the kings of the world. And then it got chipped away to reveal, no, they were just lying the whole time. And again, I'm not going to use a big word like fraud, but what I am saying is that what we all know is that, oh, Tesla is a technology company. Tesla and Elon, you know, this is how entrepreneurs, this is how you do it. The common knowledge has broken on Tesla. I mean, when you see, you know, Ross Gerber, for God's sake, who is the biggest bull ever on Tesla, the biggest bull ever, and who's now saying, oh my God, this is a disaster, get me out. When the true believers go rogue, that's when you know that the common knowledge is broken, and the common knowledge is absolutely broken on Tesla. And this is a good example of it.
I'm just curious, is it purely a supply issue? I mean, are they still claiming, you know, 3 years of backlog and it's just supply is the only reason there's 4,000, or is demand not there? Do we know?
Well, look, the demand, the backlog was you put on the website, yeah, I'll take one of those. And I forget what you had to put down, fully refundable whenever you say, no, I want off the list. So yeah, they got a ton of people saying, oh yeah, I want one of those. And then it comes out and it's like, yeah. I mean, it's an option. What they had were a lot of people say, I want to, and this makes total sense to me, right? If 4 years ago you told me, oh, I want an option on the next amazing vehicle that Elon Musk is going to roll out with. If I were into that, I'm not. I say, yeah, I'll buy that. Oh, it's a fully refundable option. It is all, the option's all my option. Yeah. I'll take a free option. Here's $1,000 for a free option. Yeah, I'd take that. So that's what they had. And I get it. Of course you want to do that. You want to drum up excitement and the like. And then my point is, you've released it, you're making them. And it's like, oh, is that all there is? It's the constant story of my mind, Elon and Tesla. You're an amazing storyteller. It's a story that people want to believe. I mean, who wants to believe this story more than Ross freaking Gerber, right? And when the story is just crushed over and over again, oh, your Tesla is going to have amazing resale value. Oh, you should pay us whatever, $14,000 now for lifetime of the autonomous driving software. But then you, A, cut the prices. So the value of your used Tesla is, you know, cut in half. B, you cut the price of the software for autonomous driving. So the people who paid up for it in full at the beginning, a lifetime of it, they're saying, what the fuck? So you can't keep pulling the rug out from people an infinite number of times. And I feel like we're at the point where Elon's done the last rug pull they can get away with. Famous last words. Maybe he comes up with another, you know, great story, which I think is now going to be robots.
It's going to be robots.
You know, it's all, and it'll just be another rug pull. It's just, it's all, Tesla's been a big rug pull. There you go.
It's also so interesting because with cars specifically, framing everything as a technology company is just one of those things, like putting .com or Bitcoin or whatever after your name.
Yep.
And the reminder that it's a car company, there's still a physical product that has to ship. So I see these numbers and it's like, holy crap, that's a small number. I've seen one of these on the road, and I'm pretty sure it was in California a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I've seen one. There's one on my way to work here, you know, my neighborhood. There's one. I've seen one. Yeah.
Okay. So like there, I guess there's 4,000 of them out there.
Yeah.
And we've each seen one in random states. I think about, and there's a great clip. I have it. It's somewhere on the Cultish Creative site. It's Jay Leno basically explaining why he won't buy a Ferrari. And car sales are hard, especially luxury car sales. And he tells this whole story about how he loves his McLaren and his Porsche, and because they treat him right and they treat him well, and you know you're spending a lot of money, but they treat you well. But he's like, the Ferrari people, the reason he refuses to own a Ferrari is because they're like, if you really want this car, first you got to show up, you got to buy two crappy cars. Yep. You got to show up with like $20,000 of cash in an envelope. He tells this insane story about all the steps before you can even get to the thing. And the reality is, Ferrari knows it's not a tech company. Ferrari knows it's a car company, and they're setting up a crappy experience to get to the good stuff. And like, here's the gap for you and Elon's tactics on this thing. It's wild to see this.
Yeah. High fashion, you know, elite fashion companies do the same thing that Ferrari's doing. And that's how Ferrari sees themselves. They see themselves as a fashion.
Right. It's a luxury item.
It's a luxury.
It's as far from commodity as you can get. And technology 100%. By all definitions is not a,
is not that. It's not that.
Jack, you got a dumb question for us this week or what?
I do. We haven't had it in a couple of weeks here, so there hasn't been enough dumbness in the podcast.
Pent up dumbness demand. Alert.
I love it.
I
love it.
I mean, I guess some could argue that all my questions throughout the podcast meet that requirement, but I like to actually name one and get to do it every time. But this is something I've been thinking a lot about, and it was sort of before the whole Russia-Ukraine thing. You know, I was someone who was thinking about the idea of Ukraine and NATO from a theoretical standpoint. And so if you do it from a theoretical standpoint, you could say, all right, Ukraine is a free country. They can do whatever they want. NATO is an organization that can admit whoever they want. Like they should be able to admit them if they want. But then you think about it from a practical standpoint and you say, well, what are the implications of that? You know, even before this conflict existed, you know, that would be an escalation with Russia. Or now, if we did it, you know, it would be, we are actually at war with Russia. And so this is something I kind of struggle with back and forth, you know, because there's been talk recently about this again, about people endorsing, you know, Ukraine going into NATO. So I was just wondering, Ben, if you could talk a little bit about this idea of how we think through whether Ukraine should be allowed to join NATO.
Yeah, yeah, happy to. I mean, this is what I did for 20 years. I mean, this was my PhD. This was the books I wrote. This was the research I did. I know John Mearsheimer, right? So. What I'm saying here isn't just kind of maybe my typical kind of musings on stuff. I think the expansion of NATO over the years, meaning since the Iron Curtain came down, has been, was a complete mistake. Not in every case, but in a lot of cases. I mean, when I think about, you know, Montenegro is part of NATO. Right. That's obscene. That's obscene. And what I mean is that there's a great line from Henry Kissinger, who I pass his wheel. I know these guys, and this is one of his best lines. And whatever you think about Henry Kissinger, and there's a lot to think about Henry Kissinger, I'll just point out, he is a patriot. He is, actually, you know, fighting and, you know, in the Battle of the, we can go on about that. I don't mean to go on about that. But hey, he's a patriot. And B, I think he understands realpolitik, meaning the reality, the guns and bombs realities of our world as well as anyone out there. And his line is, if you're allied with everyone, you're allied with no one. And it's a great line. And it's absolutely right. If you're allied with everyone, you're allied with no one. And what NATO's done is they've come on in so they can be allied with everyone. The reason it's like being allied with no one is that your commitment to launch a war against an aggressor, against every member of the alliance, becomes obvious bullshit, right? The United States is not going to launch an all-out war to defend Montenegro. I understand why in a competitive dynamic with Russia, you would want to admit more members to give at least to make them think twice. Right? You admit the Baltic states to make them think twice about going after, you know, Latvia or Lithuania. Say, well, you know, there'll definitely be a NATO response, but will it be the full, whatever, Section 5 response where, baby, it's war, where it's like France declaring war on Germany because Germany invaded Poland. That is the NATO commitment. If you're a member and you get attacked, we are declaring war, real war. I mean, it may be quiet and a phony war for a while, but it's a real war. I think it's a disaster to let Ukraine into NATO. I also think it's a disaster to let NATO have Ukraine and invade Ukraine. I think it's a disaster to let them softly invade it, like around the Crimea. And I think it's absolutely crucial that the West support Ukraine in their defense of the country today. But I am so against putting NATO, Ukraine into NATO. Part of it is like, the cat's out of the bag now. So once you expand, and I get this, right? Once the decision is made to expand NATO, then okay, we might as well let the Baltics in. We might as well admit what we used to call Eastern Europe. And we've done a lot of that. Where I would draw the line is absolutely Ukraine. Ukraine should not be part of NATO, should never be part of NATO. And the West should absolutely support Ukraine to defend itself. Those two thoughts can be held concurrently. They do not require union. So, sadly, we expanded, mistakenly, to my view, we massively expanded NATO. Once that happens, kind of cat's out of the bag, it's no longer an ironclad commitment. It's now an element of chance that you are putting in front of Russia before they cross a line. That's meaningful, but it's not as credible as having a core alliance of people who really mean it. That's where I think we are.
So, Matt, I'm embarrassed to admit that before this week, I had never watched the show Hot Ones. As we move to your cultish corner, I first want to thank you. This show is tremendous. And the most recent episode with Conan O'Brien is outstanding. And I'll let you explain it. But just the general idea here is it's an interview. Go ahead, Ben.
Jack, you are learning so much from the show. I know. You're learning about George Burns and Grace Yallon, right? You're learning, you know,
everything
from FKM, you know, you're learning a lot.
everything from like NATO expansion to like hot wings.
Yeah.
We're basically covering everything, everything in between. But
I don't know if it gets better than that.
No, yeah. But I'll let you, Matt, explain what goes on in the show, because it was a great show, and it was this particular interview was really outstanding.
So I think, beside myself, my wife and I watched this show when it came out, whenever that was, a few weeks ago, and we were both howling at the television. We're big fans of the show. We're big fans of Hot Ones. And this was, I will posit that Conan won Hot Ones.
Explain what it is, Matt, because I think there are people other than Jack who don't know what it is.
We're going to explain it. And I very likely I'll have a full on essay on this, because as I've been trying to process this for 2 weeks, and right now there's a 2,500 word document that still is not resolved yet, because I was so fascinated by this. So Hot Ones is a YouTube show. And let me start with this here, a quick survey of you guys on this, because I think this is a really interesting part to understand why this show is as important as it is. Your opinions, A, B, C, or D, multiple choice question here. Is Hot Ones a late night interview style show, B, a game show, C, a reality TV show, or D, all of the above? Jack, how would you like to vote?
I'm going to go with D, I think, but I'll see. I will defer to Ben. He knows more about this than I do.
100%. It's absolutely all of the above. It's the best bit from... It combines all the best of those genres. It is all the best of those genres. It puts it all together.
So something I'm fascinated by, and D is the correct answer.
Yeah.
And this is why the show is so important. Hot Ones is an amalgamation of show genres in one piece. And the whole reason this YouTube show and what we're doing here exists, because we're fascinated by these complex amalgamations of things. Because you know what else is an amalgamation of things besides Hot Ones? Life. Your career path, your job, parenting. These are amalgamations of multiple genres and plot types all bound together. Hot Ones does this expertly. Okay, so the way the show works, if you've never seen the show, you have Sean Evans, who's your host. You have a celebrity guest who's coming onto the show, late night TV style to promote something usually. And you have 10 wings, 10 increasingly hot sauces put on wings that the guest is going to eat while being interviewed by the host who's already eating them. Story, narrative 101. We have characters. We have a host. We have a celebrity guest. We have stakes or challenges. We have these 10 hot sauces. They are in increasing order of hotness. We have a narrative arc. Ben, do I need anything else to basically create a story?
No, but one thing you're implying, but I want to say it directly, you're putting stress. You're including stress here. And that's what gives everything, all of our story arcs, it's their urgency. It's giving fun stress, right? The stress of, oh, I'm eating something that's really spicy. It's not the stress of, oh, I could win or lose a lot of money, or I'm in danger. So it includes that element. Stress is what is the engine for every story arc. Every story arc, the engine is stress. The motor is stress.
Inside of the stress, the resistance, the stakes, is also the anticipation of that stress.
Mm-hmm.
So because as viewers, we know these are 10 successively hotter hot sauces, we also don't just feel the enjoyable stress of watching the celebrity guest struggle with an extremely relatable thing of putting something spicy in their mouths. But we know it's only going to get worse. This is another thing the show does expertly well. At the beginning part of the setup, so we have this progression, which means we have a beginning, middle, and end. As part of that progression, the beginning of the show, Sean Evans will always ask the guest, how do you feel about spicy food? How do you do with spicy food? Another little piece. This is Greek theater 101. Is it a comedy or a tragedy on the arc I'm about to experience? When Melissa McCarthy comes on the show and she is unapologetically Midwestern and doesn't do spicy food, and she's saying it, she's signaling comedy. She's signaling the host, Sean Evans, is going to be on her side. We're going to get through this together. This is not going to be fun, but we're going to laugh our way through this experience. When Idris Elba comes on and it's basically confrontational for the jump, the title of that episode is something like, he wants to, you know, have a fight with Sean Evans, the host, which he challenges him to do, the famous meme. We have a tragedy. we have someone exhibiting pride, which we'll go with before the fall when it eventually the bottom falls out. The stakes and the narrative structure, the tension that we're going to feel and the expectation of the build, that opening question, how do you feel about spicy food, is letting us know which trajectory we're on. Another point inside of this, in that opening question, we have something, and I'm not even going to get past the opening scene in this, just because this is so good, just from the setup to the Conan thing. We'll have to do a bigger piece of an episode about this when I write this thing. There's this thing, and we've talked about it on here a little bit before. It's called the status seesaw. And the status seesaw basically says we have two people in any interaction, and we're going to figure out who is of higher and lower status through the transactions, through the things that they pass back and forth. Now, Ben, when somebody goes on to a show or a talk show, how do we think about like the status of like the host and the guest? What are some classic things we know about this relationship?
Well, so much depends on, you know, is it a star coming on, right? In which case,
right,
they're the status one and the questions reflect that and the answers to it reflect it. Is it kind of a joke person appearing, in which case the host's status is greater? Anyway, and to your point, you know, Conan just turns all of this on its head.
So, Jack, we know Sean Evans, the host, has this prop that he uses to establish status through the sauces and the wings. You were most impressed, I think, from our talk before this, with Conan brings his own prop, which is one of the first ways he upends the structure of the show. Who does Conan show up with?
Yeah, Dr. Arroyo. Yeah, that was like brilliant. Dr. Arroyo, Conan even thought about that like in advance about, I mean, he was obviously thinking way in advance about how I want this to go. Yeah, Dr. Arroyo was hilarious. I mean, I won't give too much of it away for people who haven't watched it, but it was very cool.
Yeah, that's your assignment after this, as we're previewing just the first friggin' 2 minutes of the show. So you can go watch the 27 or 28 minutes of it. So Dr. Arroyo serves as a prop. And in real life, this is one of Conan's longtime writing partners. It's a really beautiful nod to somebody on his team that he's, you know, elevating by playing this goofy role. But you have to think about it this way. If the prop of the show is to triangulate around status, for the host to basically find out if this is going to be a comedy or tragedy in the celebrity guest who's come on the show, when Conan goes, and again, think of it, how do you feel about spicy food? This is a measurement question. So Conan has somebody show up that he claims is a doctor, and the doctor is going to take his temperature and do all these other things. He's brought his own prop to subvert this idea of how the show even thinks about measurement, how the show even thinks about what the prop is that gives status. Dr. Arroyo starts to talk to Sean Evans at one point, and Conan corrects him. He's like, no, you don't talk to him. You only talk to me. He berates the supposedly credentialed professional over and over again to just keep tipping his status up higher and higher and higher. And even though he says, I never tasted spice growing up in an Irish household until the age of 52, he says this. So he's giving us the humble comedic thing. But then with Dr. Arroyo, oh, has he tipped the status scale so that he will do what he does for the first basically 7/10 of the show, which is just get him as high and high and high as he can be before he's going to come crashing down in the most tragic way possible. Ben, did you have any thoughts on Dr. Arroyo? I'm just curious.
So other than it being brilliant, it was great. But I think there's one aspect of the stress and there is a truth that comes out in a lot of the words when you're under stress. And yes. I found that some of the things that Conan was saying about the common knowledge game and how audiences look at themselves and that everything that Conan said was just, he was just spitting truth there by the end of this. And it wasn't just funny. It wasn't only funny. It was also very smart and true.
Extremely smart and true, extremely aware. There's one point towards the middle where he actually starts to say, I like to announce my accidents on purpose or something to this effect, mm-hmm. to which Sean Evans responds like, no, everything is intentional here. And I will posit that, yes, every single thing was intentional here. Every choice was made through this lens. And that aspect of some of the other ways that Conan answers, right down to, I'll save it for later, but the very last thing he says, the last question about like if you were going to give a textbook to somebody to go study comedy, under the heat of all the sauces he consumes in various ways, he actually gives one of the most thoughtful and poetic answers for how we think about this stuff.
Yep.
Truly remarkable. All right. So there's more coming on Conan on Hot Ones, because apparently I have more to say about this than I bargained for, but I'm glad you guys are excited too. Go watch that before we get to the next thing. I've got some notes for us, fellas. Let's summarize
this
thing.
Wrap it up.
Yeah.
All right. So we started off, and I'm just going to say it's you have to forget left and right when we're talking about this media stuff and look at the words. That's what you're doing at fiatnews.com. That's what you're doing on that dashboard, because we're looking for who is telling you not what, but how to think. I made a note to myself, Garrison Keillor, Lake Wobegon. That's the ultimate present opinion as fact moment when you say all the women are strong, the men are good looking, and the children are above average. That is fiat news. If word choice is leading, there are ways to measure it. And I love the point you made here, extra finance terms, extra legal terms, this idea of transforming news as agent to principle. And if you remember nothing else, when you report news not as an agent, when you do it as a principal transaction, you're doing it for profit. Can't have a public entity if you're going to report news as principal. We talked about the international game of sponsors and allies and getting them into alignment. Phony wars, those are to buy time and alignment for the next phase of an attack. Ben, you said watch closely 6 to 8-ish months on this. This election in the U.S. kind of conveniently there. Everybody knows that everybody knows that too. And this is going to be a heck of an end to 2024, it sounds like. We talked about Tesla. Corporate choices. Hey, you know what? Being a CFO is a hard job. They had to invest a lot of money in some of this stuff. But the Cybertruck and the whole EV story is fundamentally broken. And why is it like Enron? Not necessarily because of fraud, but because common knowledge, Ross Gerber, it's finally breaking down here. Worth watching, worth paying attention to. We talked about NATO. We talked about Ukraine, the Kissinger quote that when you're allied with everyone, you're allied with no one. So an all-out war or real-world war, this is a dangerous proposition. And if you expand NATO and get everyone involved, then the teams that are called on to compete, that risk might be too real. So we should hold it in our minds and hearts that you can support Ukraine not as NATO, and we don't need union to be in support of something that's wrong. And finally, we talked about Conan. We talked about this, and I mean, it's the through line of this whole episode, whether we're talking about NATO and Ukraine or Tesla and EVs or this international game of sponsors and allies in Israel and NPR reporting the news. Narratives matter. It's how you tell who that matters. There's heroes and villains. There's story arcs and part of every journey. There's hot wings and sauces and steaks along the way. And we're interested because we're human. So that's the thing here. We're going to get sucked into these stories. And the best way to be human, we talked about at the beginning, clear eyes, full hearts, and you got to choose not to lose. We got to choose to learn to see the stories in which we swim. That's what we're doing here at Breaking News. Guys, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you,
Matt. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to like and subscribe wherever you're watching Breaking News so more people can find our show. If you know another clear-eyed and full-hearted individual, why not share this episode with them too? Like we said at the top, the media is making us tick, and it's our job to talk. Follow the headlines at fiatnews.com. Follow Ben at epsilontheory.com and at epsilontheory on Twitter. Follow Jack at validiacapital.com and at practicalquant on Twitter. Follow Matt at sunpointinvestments.com, cultishcreative.com, and at cultishcreative on Twitter.